Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am Michael, your host. Today, David and I have a lot to get through in the ways of Star Trek Discovery. Hello, Dave. How are you doing?
Hello, everybody.
If you are new to our podcast, I do want to recommend that you head over to your preferred podcast provider and search Star Trek From the Holodeck and add us to your favorites, your playlists. Give us a thumbs up, rate, review if you are an active user of Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So, David, we are going to tackle the second installment of Star Trek Discovery's fifth and final season, titled Under the Twin Moons. David, the new season is absolutely off to a solid start.
Yes. Yeah. And it really makes sense now with them releasing kind of these two episodes side by side, because they really wanted to get their season started off on the right foot.
Yeah. I mean, you have that continual focus on concise action, character development, mixed with a plethora of Star Trek thematics that we are familiar with.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, David, about the part one and two, in large part, this episode does in fact feel not like just another installment of a serialized series, but veers closer to what I would call an actual counterpart episode, a part two. Does, in retrospect, now make sense why they decided to drop two episodes on premiere day. I mean, it's ideal for viewers, but not ideal for us, David, because we can never tackle two episodes at once. We can't sit in here for 3.5 hours.
No.
It's just too much.
That'd be too much.
Yeah. Typically, though, I would say one can notice the differences when you pay attention to the plot specifics. And of course, I'm talking about this season of Star Trek Discovery so far.
Mm-hmm.
You can notice the difference when you pay attention to plot specifics and the key individual character arcs that are actively tightened and brought into alignment with our main story direction, or in the case of the narrative itself, and the overall coherence and thematic consistency becomes more apparent with this second installment. The reason why, even though I loved the last episode, the reason why I gave it an 85%, because I know you had questions pertaining to that.
Yeah.
But it was because it was a lot of setup. It was sorting through things, and there wasn't any true finality to some of those arcs. And not in the typical way when you think of a serialized series. It felt more open-ended. And now, after watching the second episode, I see exactly what they were trying to do. Because all of those things that were set up in that first episode were already brought into the greater mythos of this season in a very meaningful and impactful way, to where we have a clear snapshot of what the myth arc of the season is going to be.
Yeah.
And what each of our characters, for the most part, are going to be dealing with, struggling with, trying to come to terms with throughout the rest of the season.
A deeper look into those characters, because like in episode one, we kind of got a very superficial look at what they were going to be doing. But it's interesting, like the way that this episode in particular opened up, this felt like, okay, we have all this set up from episode one. Now this is going to be kind of like Discovery is like launching point, because it was interesting that I remember making the comment that the last episode felt different because it didn't start off the typical way with, you know, Burnham talking on her captain's log. It didn't start like that. It started with action right away, here's Burnham. She's at this point. She's been thrust onto this situation. And then we flash back four hours later.
You know what they did in a lot of ways? They took cues from feature film writing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not always a fan of that because television and movies are a completely different medium. But the way Michelle Paradise did it, it actually worked. Because if you look at the first episode, it works and functions a lot like the inciting incident of a feature film.
Yeah.
It basically introduces you to everything. It sets little things up, but it's more about enticing the audience, letting us know what we're about to see.
It is basically kind of like the first, with some action films, what they do is the first 10 minutes is your inciting incident.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you cut to credits and that's where the movie begins.
Right.
In very much the same fashion, the second episode, when you take a look at it, it does the same thing. You have an inciting incident, credits, and then suddenly now it's Burnham talking on the captain's log, talking about the situation that she's in now.
Yeah.
And this feels more like, okay, this is where we're going to set up what the myth arc of the entire season is going to be about.
And not just the myth arc, but also the individual character arcs, at least of our main players. That was also something that I believe I said during our last recording. I said there was some characters missing. There wasn't a lot there. And now we see those things bringing together. And, you know, just like I was saying at the top of the show, this episode took those aspects and brought finality to the initial staging of the season. And also, one of the strengths of this episode was how it started, because it gave the viewer a glimpse into the potential philosophical and epistemological functions of the season. For example, Burnham's personal log, as you mentioned, was a great way of fleshing out these very things. When we hear Burnham's musings about the meaning of life, it effectively reflects an existential attitude,
mm-hmm.
where by the inclusion of the progenitors as a plot motivator becomes more than just simply a MacGuffin, but an actual narrative function that helps the viewer grasp the implications of the governing philosophical themes of the season.
Yeah. And that's the important part. We remember last episode we were saying, well, are they going to use the progenitor thing as a MacGuffin?
Mm-hmm.
Now here, it's not being used as a MacGuffin, but it's basically just like what you said. It's a gateway into the opening, like the questioning myth arc of the entire season, or at least for the season. And what I liked about the entire episode compared to the first episode was like everyone, all the characters that were quote unquote, like in main focus, their main stories tied to the myth arc. If you look at all the, if you look at the major characters, you know, you have Burnham questioning about her purpose. You look at Saru, who is also trying to find his own purpose because he's always thought, oh, I've been wanting to be a captainship. Suddenly I want to be an ambassador. I want to be with the Vulcan president. He's trying to find his purpose in life.
Yeah.
And when he, even throughout the episode, when he's talking to Burnham and saying that I think I'm finding my purpose.
Exactly.
That was started to have the clues that basically, okay, that's how Saru's again trying to harp back to the myth arc. And not only that, you have Rainer, which I am so happy he's back. And it looks like he's going to be back pretty much full time in a position that I was hoping he'd be in.
The doggy style position?
With Burnham.
I would ship that. But hey, listen, she's not with Book anymore.
She's not with Book anymore. She can't be because they're different paths now.
Yeah.
And like even with Book. Book's purpose now in life.
It's all governed under the similar existential threads.
Yep.
So that's why it becomes more clear to us now, the audience, of course, that the idea of the progenitors is far more involved than just a novel idea that connects the series to TNG, but has a narrative symbolic significance that actually helps to develop the overall narrative. Basically, it enriches thematic depth, providing layers of meaning beyond its surface appearance. And that's what I was looking for. I was really paying close attention to everything that they were doing in this second episode because I was looking for real intention behind the introduction of the progenitor, something that's never really been touched on again.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been touched on at I think Voyager might have mentioned the progenitors during its 7-year run, but it was almost in passing.
Yes, it's always in passing because you got to remember back then, the idea, the concept of the progenitors was very controversial for Star Trek fans.
Right.
I mean, yeah. The whole concept itself, while it's something that was used to hopefully strengthen the idea of Roddenberry's utopia idea that everyone can get along because we're all one being or one, you know, species in that case, like everyone's the same.
We're genetically unified.
Unified. So in essence, we should all be unified in one federation. But when it was first put out there by TNG, the one thing that basically a lot of fans rallied against was the philosophical ideas that concept opened up.
Right.
Where it was like, okay.
Yeah, but you can control that. And I think that's what TNG did. They didn't allow it to go down this existential dread type of path.
Yes.
They controlled the narrative to where it was just simply a way to flesh out the universe, to show that we are connected. And as we mentioned during our last discussion, in a lot of ways, it was an allegory for Gene Roddenberry's original intention or his vision of the future for humanity. Mm-hmm. The idea that we're all connected, our common ground is that we are all a part of humanity. And that's why it worked in a lot of ways. It wasn't there in some larger way to position any type of existential angst or pose existential questions, because that's not really a thing in Star Trek. But that's why it's intriguing that the writers are using notes of existentialism, because typically Trek is not an IP where those types of ideas work cohesively.
Typically, but it's funny because in Star Trek, you have these moments in Trek where they do, but they never go full on into it.
Like, they're just moments. And I would probably even say, just to keep it very simple, it's more like icing.
Yeah. It's kind of like,
it's not deeply embedded within the narrative. Whereas, well, hold on. Like, for example, like what you're alluding to is probably things dealing with Kirk.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. And Kirk has never been an existential character, but there has been moments
especially
where
in
they
the movies
used ideas, notions of existentialism to help the understanding, to help the audience understand what's actually at stake and what these characters are going through, mm-hmm. or I should say Kirk. But typically, when looking at Trek as a whole, its view of the future and its optimistic origins don't always align with such an idea like existentialism.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I believe DS9, if we had to point to one Star Trek series, DS9 leaned into it a bit few episode arcs, particularly episodes. I believe it was the Maquis episodes when they were first introduced, because the whole idea of the Maquis literally flipped the optimism of Star Trek on its head.
Oh yeah. And also, like, that just proves our point that basically Star Trek has delved moments into this. Like, not only like Kirk, and there is so many in Deep Space Nine that basically you have those times in those episodes where it's like all of a sudden, like, Star Trek wants to delve and question into this existential dread of humanity, of the human condition. Like, say, for example, Quark's nephew, when he comes back, and that whole episode of him coming back from war and missing a leg.
But why does it work for a character like that, Dave? Because he's not necessarily a part of the human
condition,
species, yes. Or the human species. So Deep Space Nine always walked this tightrope. And the reason why they can even do that with a lot of their stories is because of their I don't want to say disconnect from the Federation and Starfleet, but they were so far flung at the other side of the universe that they were almost alone. And they were dealing with things that didn't always pertain to the United Federation of Planets and Starfleet. They were dealing a lot with Bajoran politics, Bajoran mysticism, the invasion of the founders. So because of that, they were able to shift those ideas here and there. But even then, Deep Space Nine never relied on it so much so that it was a part of the DNA of a character throughout an entire season.
Yeah.
Or even within an episode, it's always just little notes, little introductions of these ideas so that it helps audiences connect and understand things at a more intimate or emotional level.
That's why I brought up Kirk in the first place, because to me, in my memory of recollection of like Star Trek, he is probably the only character I can think of that had tackled almost like that idea of that existential dread, because he had a inciting incident in the movies where his son died, because it was after when his son died that you suddenly see Kirk questioning his purpose about getting older. Why is he getting older now? And it all started at Wrath of Khan when David gets introduced, but then when David dies in the next episode, it just takes his character over, where it's like the only purpose he has is to be in that chair.
I would agree with that. That if we had to point to one character in Star Trek, Kirk was one character that they continually used notes of existentialism to craft his individual arcs here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not against its use in Trek, even though I am a purist, but you have to be very careful, or you do risk undermining the very key foundational concepts of Star Trek. For example, the very basics of existentialist thought, so that people have some context here, is this acknowledgement of the challenges, absurdities, and uncertainties of human existence, and the recognition that we live in a fragmented, broken world. That is what philosophers call the existential attitude. But there's also the existential philosophical process of seeking or creating meaning and purpose in one's life despite this recognition of existential dilemmas. So basically, and in simple terms, it is a process of self-discovery and self-definition. Now, that last bit sounds like it's been embedded thematically since day one in Discovery.
Yes.
I believe there's an argument to be made that large swaths of Discovery's texts have been doused with a bit of existentialism since day one. But my point is, you do have to be careful how you walk this line, because if the writers don't fully grasp these notions, you can break the archetypal governing themes of Trek. That being said, if one were to walk that tightrope of existentialism can lead to optimism, because of the very basis of the philosophical process of seeking one's purpose and meaning. Once those are discovered through introspection and self-discovery, you now have a clear path that leads to optimism. So if they fully understand this, then everything they're doing and introducing with Burnham and these other characters will absolutely work out beautifully.
It's kind of like whenever I hear stories like this being written and people trying to tackle it, one of the best lines in movies that I think tackle it the best was from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, when when at the very end, Indiana Jones looks at his dad and says, "What did you find?" And he says, "I found illumination." He found purpose. His purpose his whole life was actually to find the Holy Grail. But in actuality, there was more to that than in his purpose. His purpose was his son. And then that's why, like, when I see stuff like that, I think it can work well in Discovery. That's the kick. That's the kicker, though. I think Discovery is the only Star Trek series that can do something like this.
Especially if You read that essay I wrote, that academic paper about Discovery and looking to the past in order to find an optimistic future.
Yeah.
Okay. So Discovery, you're right, David. Discovery has used these things for so long. It is built into its DNA, but I don't know if it's ever been quite front and center like this season, because they're not just using existentialism in, say, various themes from episode to episode, or a maybe just one specific character. They're actually using it overtly because of the way they had Burnham make that statement via her personal log at the very opening minutes of this episode. That's them letting everyone know this is the current mind state of not just Burnham, but our core characters this season.
Yes.
And they haven't made that type of a thesis statement in the 5 years so far.
No. And that's the thing is like, and this is not saying, oh, Discovery is better than any, this no. is why Discovery is better. Discovery is better tooled to handle something like this than say something like a Strange New Worlds. In Strange New Worlds, it's supposed to harken back to Gene Roddenberry's belief of optimism. That's why the core, that's why you have those high energy philosophical moments in Strange New Worlds. Whereas the flip side is you have the existential thoughts that come in that can't fit into Strange New Worlds.
Yeah. That's why, like you said, that it's been around. I agree with you. It's been around with Discovery since day one.
Oh, yeah.
It's always been there. And you said that, what was the exact word you just used, Dave? That Discovery is the perfect series for that?
It's the perfectly tailored series for that type of writing.
And the reason why, this is what I was trying to say, and I totally lost my train of thought halfway through, dealing with my academic paper I wrote. So you are right, David, because my entire thoughts on Discovery is that it is an allegory. If you trace seasons one through season, let's say four, I don't know what's happening yet in season five. It is parallel, or I should say the show is placed in parallel with the things that we're going through in today's world. That's how Star Trek's always operated.
Yeah.
In the 90s, TNG was working, 80s and 90s was working alongside the things that were going on sociopolitically in that time period. Deep Space Nine, same thing. Voyager, same thing. Enterprise, same thing. Discovery, exact same thing. And what are we dealing with in today's contemporary society? We're dealing with existentialism. We're dealing with a loss of faith in our institutions. Why do you think the Federation was fragmented and broken in season three? It was an allegory for our loss of faith in our institutions.
Yeah.
Our disorientation. So when you trace the path that Discovery's been on since day one, getting to where we are today, it actually makes perfect sense that this is where we are.
Oh, yeah. And if you think about it, too, the fun thing that I thought about in thinking about how this myth arc means to Discovery as a whole, ever since day one, all of the characters within Discovery have gone through that existential mindset. Their paths have always changed, whether it's Burnham going from a mutineer to suddenly she's the captain of Discovery, to Saru to being like the first alien captain, to suddenly he's going to be an ambassador. Their paths are always changing, even down to like characters like Tilly, Stamets, and Culber. All of them since day one, they're different people because their purpose has changed throughout all of the seasons of Discovery. And that's why I think that when it comes to the Star Trek series, Discovery is the one that has the chemistry that can handle something like this. I can't imagine Strange New Worlds doing this.
The dynamics.
Yeah, the dynamics, because so many not just the characters themselves, but so many fans would be so burned out by watching Pike go through an existential crisis. Are you kidding me? Everyone would be like hating on Strange New Worlds because we have this set mindset of who Pike is. We have this set mindset of who Spock is. He has to be this. It's like the one thing that basically me and you talked about, how legacy characters can't change because fans won't allow it. They can't allow them to have existentialism because that would destroy us. Getting to see like Discovery, we are seeing these characters go through these changes time and time again, and it's almost become like a natural process. So seeing Burnham go through this question makes sense. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, Burnham can handle this. Because wherever she ends up, if she doesn't end up the captain of Discovery at the end, oh, well, she'll find her purpose in something.
Yeah. So I do find all of this extremely intriguing, but I'm also optimistically cautious. And keeping with this, we can also look to many of our characters. And you had previewed this a moment ago, because each of the ones who've been, is that the proper way of saying that? Each of the characters who've been brought to the foreground so far in this season are facing those similar questions regarding the future and purpose. Tilly seems to be excluded from this because I think they're bringing her back only because it just feels right to bring her back. But they've already been trying to get her ready for the next show. Now, possibly Tilly will eventually fit the mold, but as of right now, it's there. We need more to determine whether or not she does fit into this mold. But
yeah.
But look at Stamets having to confront the end of his life's work. Where does he go from here?
Exactly.
Book is no longer in control of his life, essentially taking on similar functions as Sisyphus, you know, pushing that rock up a hill day in, day out. Mm-hmm. Saru actively in pursuit of a new purpose. Captain Rayner having to confront a new world of politics that he's unfamiliar with. Burnham, who has lost her motivations, drive, and purpose, something Starfleet has always given her before. So overall, these notions of existentialist thought keep the series coherent and adds to, I would say it definitely adds to narrative integrity, because it has, those notes have been intertwined throughout the series. The only question that I have is how and why did Burnham fall into this state of existentialism? Because to have a character overtly state something like that, like we heard in those opening minutes of the episode, I mean, we can theorize by looking at the overall series like we've just been doing and how the fourth season ended. But for this idea to fully work, we will need to understand these particular motivations a bit more. We need to understand what happened between season 4 and 5 to where now she suddenly doesn't have purpose and she's not quite sure what to do. She seems unhappy.
This is something that I actually thought about in my notes, because I was thinking like you, is like suddenly Burnham's changed. But when you actually understand existential, I wouldn't
say she changed.
Yeah.
For her to state something like that,
she's questioning it.
We may understand that there's narrative cohesion there, but for purposes of audience understanding, most people don't sit and analyze 4 seasons.
Exactly.
You're going to have to give us something to let us know why she suddenly feels this way at this moment in time.
That's why I said, is like the only reason why I came up with this assumption that I'm making now. Is the fact that you could say that Burnham is at a point where she feels like she's hit her peak and now she's stagnant. She's the captain of Discovery. She is the flagship bearer of the Federation. She's hit it all. And now she's at that point where a lot of people who get to the top suddenly feel, well, where do I go from here? Do I just stay here?
Back to the bottom.
Or yeah, do I go back to the bottom? And it's like, I think that's the story that I think they're going to tell with Burnham, is Burnham's going to be at this point where she's hit everything. She's done everything that was asked of her.
Do you think they're going to remove her from the timeline somehow? Do you think this is what they're trying to do? because we know that by the end of the season, they're going to have to explain why in Short Treks, Discovery has been pushed out. It is essentially hidden away.
Yes.
And pushed further into the future.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is kind of like, okay, we know what Short Treks establish and that's what they're heading towards. I'm thinking that basically something like that must have happened, where Burnham basically has to make that decision to leave the timeline and find a new purpose, you know, transcend where she is. You know, it's funny because
at the end of the day, isn't that the...
That's the chase of all of the Star Trek characters.
Yeah.
Is some kind of transcendence.
I think the only one that's ever reached true transcendence, though, is Sisko. He became a fucking god.
He became a god. Or no, the guy also that ran into the koala god in Lower Decks. He transcended and he became perfect.
Yeah, that's not the same thing. Yeah, that was a sheer agony and horror for him, if you remember.
Existentialism.
That's different than physical pain, dude.
But like, that's a really good, and that's an even a bigger thing that I thought about, is like, I couldn't think of any characters that basically transcend their purpose in Star Trek. Like,
I mean, Spock, if you take his entire story from beginning to end, there's transcendence there. But that's taking in the entire history of Spock. The entire
history, though. You have to transcend not just the original series, but also the films and TNG, and then up to Picard.
Exactly.
And then it's like, with Jean-Luc Picard, it's kind of like he's been stagnant for years. When you think about it,
yeah,
that transcendence is really difficult, but all the characters seem to chase it.
Yeah. Well, isn't that what we all kind of chase? Even if we don't know that's what we're chasing, we are all looking for some type of transcendence.
That is true.
That's the human condition.
That's the human condition. Yeah.
It's interesting to see everything, how it's panning out. Briefly, a bit more before we move on about the aspect of Discovery from Short Treks. Now, we also have to remember, because this can actually be explained very easily. You go back to season 2, Star Trek Discovery, I believe the way they explained the need for Discovery to shoot off into the future was in order for them to stay ahead of the AI, they had to go so far into the future so that they can basically escape the clutches of this AI. But they also said that they would have to do this perpetually because eventually the AI will catch up. So we could also look at that Short Treks episode essentially just being another moment where the crew has to abandon Discovery and send Zora and Discovery off on their own, which is sad as hell for Zora.
Oh, for Zora? That's terrible.
If she's the one that takes on the responsibility of having to move Discovery beyond the reach of the AI.
But that's the thing with Zora. It's like, I feel sorry. If that is the point, if that is the purpose of Zora, that's a sad purpose. Because like, even then, that's even a more terrible fate, because that's Zora's purpose, is to constantly be perpetually going into the future just to get away from the AI that's plagued them since, I think it was like season 2. And that's the other thing. I don't know how fans would take it, Mike, if the AI suddenly at the end, are you saying that basically we have to see at the end of this season, the AI shows up and then they have to boom Zora out of here?
I think that's a bad idea. I don't like that. However, if they remind us that that's the original mission of Discovery,
for Zora.
The new mission of Discovery, or I should say the responsibility of Discovery to keep itself out of the reach of the evil AI. All they have to do is mention it and then have this sad farewell. That's how it ends.
That's how it ends. Man, that's tough, because I don't think Star Trek could end on a sad note.
Well, Discovery kind of ended. Not Discovery, Deep Space Nine kind of ended on a sad note. There I don't want to say a sad note. Maybe it was sad because of my emotional investment with the show. Because if you look at all of the shows, how they ended, all of the Star Trek shows.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine is the only series that had true finality and closure.
No, yeah.
It was like, all right, let's close the lights down. Let's close the curtains. Everyone, please exit. That's exit. What it felt like.
Yeah. But I mean, even
if I would be, I think Discovery is one of those shows that can actually do the same thing. That. Yeah.
Because even for me, that'd be an interesting discussion between me and you is to see like,
well, that's why we're having it.
Is the end of, well, think about this.
You mean we like a whole separate show
on the end of DS9.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We could do that.
Because that could be like
a five-parter.
You can make an argument. Was it a sad ending or was it a happy ending? Because it's funny that you bring it up, seeing it as a sad ending is like, you know, a finality.
I'm just an emotional wreck. Okay.
But like on my end, DS9 also ended very optimistically still because there was still that idea. Oh, Sisko's out there. He's just a god now. Mm. He's watching over everybody, even Jaco.
Yeah. All right, David. So let's bring it back to Discovery and let's switch gears and talk about the tone of how this episode is written and how its musical score adds to this shift. As a devoted fan, I really enjoyed what they did because this episode epitomized the essence of classic Star Trek. Now, while I have to do a disclaimer here, Dave, because we all know that often I advocate for innovation and the resistance of mere nostalgia grabs. But this episode demonstrated an approach to honoring the franchise legacy while maintaining Discovery's distinct identity. At the same time.
Oh, no, yeah.
For example, the writer, McElroy, I believe was his name, he wrote the episode under the episodic spirit of the original series movies and series. He took the most engrossing elements of both and used them to create a very concise cinematic flair to the action, which is something I was very closely watching because it was very different than things we've seen in the past in Discovery, mm-hmm. but also it was offering some of the best aspects of those quest-like episodes that by design require this investigative spirit. I think at this point, Star Trek fans are all very familiar with those episodes where Kirk and Spock must solve some esoteric riddle or puzzle yes. or find yeah. their way through an elaborate labyrinth.
That's why, because this whole... The whole episode was tailored kind of like a classic.
Absolutely.
Star Trek episode where it felt...
It had the swashbuckling antics.
Yeah.
The musical cues that match those antics.
And the thing that had me worried at first when I was watching it, going, this seems like they were trying to do what Strange New Worlds is supposed to do.
It was different.
But it just had that little touch of difference in just how the narrative was actually being displayed.
That was my fear, Dave. I'm glad you brought that up because we talked about this at length prior to the premiere of Discovery's fifth season. We talked about this idea that Kurtzman and Paradise had been talking about, that they're going to switch the tone of the show. They're going to go more in line with Strange New Worlds episodic format. And you and I threw our hands up in the air and said, why would you do that? You already have a show doing that.
Yes.
You have Discovery that's unique. It's its own thing. Let it be its own thing. If people don't like it, guess what? Fuck them.
Fuck
them
at this point.
The show has been on the air for 4 years. If you don't like the show, you're not going to win those people over at this point.
Yeah, it's your final season.
The jig is up. Stay true to what you've done. But what they are doing is, it's a compromise. They are messing around with the tone, but they're still adhering to what Discovery is as well.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted. I don't mind if they play with narrative strategy, different ways to bring the audience into the show. I'm okay with that, but don't forsake what the series is in order to pacify the toxic nature of certain fans.
Don't change your identity, especially since it's your last season.
Yeah.
It makes it at the time it made no, it made no structural sense and creative sense to suddenly, you know, let's change our mind when we don't have another season already planned.
Yeah. Prank caller.
Exactly. It was a prank caller moment. And it's like, I'm really interested to see if they, like what we've been saying throughout looking at this episode, can they actually still take that Discovery identity and do this type of writing? And in two episodes, especially when you take both of them into context, it works.
It does.
Shockingly, it works.
I really dug it. I really like what they're doing with the action this season, because they're not throwing out the general rule book for Discovery. They're just altering it a bit. And I'm okay with that. That is okay. And what's cool about this entire thing is it does look like every episode might be written within that same spirit because of the nature of the guiding myth arc. Because every episode is a new quest. That's what it looks like it's doing. You have to, yeah. you're tracking those breadcrumbs.
And it still leaves you with wanting to watch more. Yes, I'm a little hesitant just because I'm like going, can they possibly do this, jumping to another quest type of episode, but still continue on the theme? And they show that they can. So it'll be interesting to now it makes the audience want to tune in for the next episode.
Yeah. And I prefer serialized storylines anyways. One of the biggest problems with Strange New Worlds that I have, even though I really love that show, if I had to gripe about a few things on that show, is the fact that it's episodic and it's only 10 episodes. And what that does is it leaves us not really quite fulfilled or satisfied, because you have 10 episodes where you're not really being able to get into the ins and outs, the nitty gritty that we as Star Trek fans are used to. We're accustomed to that.
Well, you end up losing characters. I mean, in the last, while I really enjoyed the last season of Strange New Worlds, the biggest gripe that everyone constantly had was you didn't have Pike in it.
Pike was missing. He's the fucking captain. Pike was missing
for half of the season.
Yeah. And we understand why there was behind the scenes personal issues. We get that. But that's the reason why Strange New World, if they're going to keep doing that, they need to add at least 5 to 8 more episodes for it to be more effective. Because it doesn't quite work the way they're doing it. And that's one of the reasons why I was a little fearful that this was the final season of Discovery. And those remarks about trying to take some nods from, or making nods to Strange New Worlds, is like, why? It didn't even work that great for Strange New Worlds.
And the problem that Strange New Worlds has too is like they keep introducing new characters to add to the cast. I mean, like the past season was Kirk, introducing Kirk into the whole season. And while it was fun,
It was great. But also distracted.
It was a distraction at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Now, I do think that Discovery can do that, because if we look at like how they've done for the whole season, they've actually did it with a nice ensemble cast.
Yes.
So
you just need, sometimes shows need more time. And I know that's just the nature of the business practice for streaming platforms nowadays, to keep your budgets high. It's so contradictory, dude. Let's keep our budgets extremely high so we can make our series look really snazzy. But let's not give ourselves enough time due to budget restraints to actually flesh out a season more fully realized. It's fucking ass backwards, and it's not the fault of the writers. That's why I'm not pointing fingers at them. It is the people who lord over the creative laborers.
Oh, yeah.
That it's not their fault.
It's the system.
Yeah.
It's the system in the end of the day, because like giving such big budgets to other big shows just leads them to become lazy.
Here you guys go. Here's $20 million for an episode, but I'm only going to give you 6 episodes.
Exactly. But I'm going to cut you here.
Yeah.
So you might be thinking, oh, we got this huge budget. But guess what? You don't have enough time to actually give your story. Enough time to breathe. So we got to rush everything.
All right, Dave, let's talk about Captain Rayner.
Is he going to be your favorite character for the season?
Well, so far he's definitely climbing that ladder. He is now officially a part of Discovery's crew. He's going to be the first officer, and I couldn't be more pleased. The series has, in my opinion, has long needed a character like this. A character like this particular one is he's an excellent writing tool.
Yeah.
They offer, when you look at characters like that, they offer pushback, alternative perspectives that then motivate our key players to think critically about their actions. And that's something that Burnham does need. Burnham needs a foil.
Oh, no, absolutely. That's why I love that line.
That last line?
Where he says, I am not a yes man.
Yeah, yep.
And she basically looks back at him and says, and that's why I chose you. And I'm like going, exactly. Burnham, at least we're seeing that growth in Burnham that she understands.
That's what I was about to say. Talk about growth. How long have we been talking about this? We need to see now, again, I don't want, it sounds like we're being negative, but this is something we have been advocating for a very long time. We need to see that maturity.
Well, because
and we did see it in the fourth season of Discovery. Absolutely. But the fact that you start this season with having her make a statement like that, understanding that she doesn't want a yes man, she does want someone to push back on her.
Mm-hmm.
That shows the growth of a character, especially a character like that who has, by design, it was design wasn't an accident. The writers did design this character to be impetuous, a little bit of knee jerky, and now you see someone who's more slow to action, mm-hmm. willing to listen a bit more. She has her pillars of wisdom to go to.
Yeah.
Saru, Tilly, and now we have Captain Rayner. I think the show is really, I hate to say this, but the show is operating at all levels right now.
It is.
And it's sad that this is the final season, because I said this last year, David, when they announced that the fifth season will be the final year for Discovery. And I said, that's a shame, because the show finally found its feet in season three.
Oh, yeah. And the thing that cracks me up the most is, like, it's always the final season of any of the Star Trek series that we have our favorite character show up, whether it's Strange New Worlds, whether it's Picard, whether it's Discovery. We always find that one character, even a lot of the fans are talking about it, how Rayner is kind of like that, the character that when Picard season three happened, it was the captain of the Enterprise at that point that everyone loved, who was like the Quint type of
and they killed him.
Yeah, and they killed him.
Yeah.
But it was his only season that we would get that captain. And now in Discovery, this is the only season where we'll get Captain Rayner. And also the thing I like about Rayner is his dynamic with Burnham, just overall. And I don't know, I wanted to bring this up to you about how it almost flips the idea of Star Trek's most beloved, you know, dynamic, which is Kirk and Spock.
Mm-hmm.
Rayner and Burnham are like the parallel opposites of that dynamic. You have Kirk, who was the captain, and Spock was the first officer. He would listen to Kirk, and, you know, he would be Kirk's mentor in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Rayner's more like Kirk, and Burnham is more like Spock. And here, Burnham is the Spock figure, the philosophical Spock figure, mm-hmm. is the one that is the captain. They're the ones that basically is front and center.
So meanwhile, Rayner, the dynamic
mm-hmm. is flipped.
Yeah.
And I was like going, that is cool. And I want them to, I hope that they play around with that more.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I'm really excited with everything they've given us so far. I think this is the most exciting start to Star Trek Discovery that we've had. And that's saying a lot coming from me, because to the dismay of some of our listeners, this is my favorite Star Trek of the new era. And I know people sent me messages asking, but why? And I'm like, I told you why. Let's do our show. Because it's deep, it's philosophical, it's intellectual. It's what Star Trek should be. That's what Star Trek's always been. So, all right. You know, we need to wrap our show for today. I'm going to give this episode a 91%, which is significantly higher than the last episode. Dave, you?
I'm my score is close to yours, just because now when I look back at it, I can't take it over the first episode. So Because I enjoyed the first episode a lot.
Why can't it take over the score from the first episode? Why can't it be higher?
Because then I'd be seen as a hypocrite.
Why? you didn't say anything that would be hypocritical.
But I would be, because I was saying like the first episode blew my doors off. Here, this solidified what I loved about the first episode.
It blew the doors off. But you gave it an 89%. That's not a blow the doors off score. I think you just contradict yourself a lot when it comes to the grades.
So I don't want to add too much to that contradiction. So I actually gave this one a 90.
It is higher than the episode score from last.
It's equal. I'm going to say brain it's equal, because if I said it was an 89,
none of this makes any sense anymore. I'm going to end the show now.
You like that math?
That's not math, David. I don't know what David is. All right, let's wrap the show, because I guess that's a 90% studio score. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.